Welcome to the Animal Law Podcast. This is Marianne Sullivan. My guest this week is once again Christopher Berry of the Animal Legal Defense Fund, and I am so excited about this interview. It involves a California case entitled Kairu SPCA versus Anthony. And this case involves a successful effort to close down a backyard breeder puppy mill kind of situation, which is like really, really great news. But there are also some hugely important implications for this case, which go way beyond the case itself, and in which the Kairu SPCA, which has a really interesting origin story that Christopher will tell us about, uses an old but virtually never used California statute that allows humane societies to bring cases to court to protect animals who are being subject to illegal treatment. What? You got to hear this. This could definitely be the start of something big for animal law, and you are going to be so glad you didn't miss this episode. Before we get to that, I'd just like to take a moment and ask you for your support for our Hen House, which is, of course, the not-for-profit that produces this podcast, along with the our Hen House podcast. And if you can help out, please go to ourhenhouse.org/donate. You can always join our flock for $10 a month or $100 a year. You can also just make whatever donation that you are able to or comfortable with. And if you can't afford it right now, we understand. Our supporters always know, I think, that they are helping to provide animal-friendly media for themselves, but also for others who can't afford right now to contribute. And thank you so much to all who do. And of course, if you haven't yet done so, please check out the Our Hen House podcast, which I co-host along with Jasmine Singer. A couple of recent episodes that might be of particular interest include episode 578 with amazing, amazing New York State Senator and passionate animal activist Jabari Brisport, represents a district in New York City, and episode 579 featuring Angela Grimes of Born for USA. And she spoke about many of the challenges facing wild animals, which of course are many, but we particularly focused on the links between wet markets that sell wild animals and the risks of pandemics, like this one that is ruining all of our lives. And the fact that this is not more of a thing, that we can't do that anymore, just boggles my mind. I assume it does yours as well. All right, let's get to the interview because you're going to love it. Christopher Berry is a managing attorney in the Animal Legal Defense Fund's litigation program, where he oversees strategic impact litigation to protect the lives and advance the interests of animals. He will be joining me right after this. I want to tell you about an amazing service for anybody who's practicing animal law or interested in animal law. The Brooks Animal Law Digest is a premier free online publication dedicated to offering in-depth and up-to-date coverage on today's most important animal law and policy issues. Published weekly as a collaborative effort with Harvard Law School's Animal Law and Policy Program, the Digest is a Brooks Institute service to the animal protection community. It can be like having a full-time lawyer on your staff researching and reporting to you on U.S. current legal developments related to animal protection issues. This digest is a resource for anyone interested in learning more about the field of animal law, either as a high-level overview of weekly developments for those who are focused on specific work, but nevertheless want to stay aware of other actions, or as a jumping-off point for digging into a specific current issue in the field. Features include allowing you to compile updates by category, search by key terms, and each issue contains links to background materials that will orient the reader around that specific issue. There are weekly highlights as well as quarterly summaries. You can subscribe to the Brooks Animal Law Digest at thebrooksinstitute.org. Welcome to the Animal Law, or welcome back to the Animal Law Podcast, Christopher.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me back.
I'm super excited to talk about this case. The case is interesting in and of itself, but, you know, maybe not the most complex case we've ever covered, but lots of interesting issues. But the implications of it are staggering, just staggering. So that's what I really want to talk about, because it's the way you brought this case that really got me so interested in this. So first of all, let's start with the facts, as all good lawyers do. Can you just tell us about this Operation California Carolina Dogs?
I think the best way to describe it is it's, you know, essentially like a puppy mill and a hoarding situation, sort of combined into one. It's a breeding operation in a residential at least has been in a residential area, breeding this breed of dogs called Carolina dogs. They've been called, I think, like the American Dingo. I'm a dog person. I've actually never heard of this breed
before. I've never heard of them either.
Yeah. Yeah. They call it like the American Dingo. I guess it's like a Southern, you know, Carolina
right.
breed that kind of become feral from, I think maybe from domestic dogs or like, you know, they kind of just kind of this feral dog breed. And then, you know, they've been domesticated and, this operation, a woman in the Bay Area of California has been breeding them at our house. Unfortunately, you know, for the dogs and neighbors and others, it's a situation where the dogs have been running at large. They're, you know, including occasionally biting people. There's nuisance barking, complaints of smells, and because of the nuisance barking and the dogs getting out and the smells, animal control had been called over a period of years, frequently visiting the property and documenting, you know, at times dozens of dogs. I think there was one animal control log saying that they thought there were more than 50 dogs at this residential property, right? This is just a house, sort of like a suburb kind of a feel to it with a bunch of, you know, neighbors that also live there. And so that's essentially the backdrop for all of this.
And all right, this may be a little bit unusual as puppy mills go, which are, you know, you don't hear about dogs running free in puppy mills. So it's a little bit more casual in operation, but probably not that unbelievably unusual. So how did it come to your attention as something that you should be paying attention to?
I mean, we got wind of this because, you know, the neighbors were upset. This was a nuisance, right? Imagine flies, imagine smelling dog urine and dog feces, hearing the barking, worrying about the dogs getting out, like barking at you when you walk by. You know, even though animal control was going out and there was, you know, some semblance of law enforcement going on, they never escalated it beyond kind of like warnings. And I think at one point there was a kind of like a cease and desist letter, maybe a paltry fine. I can't remember offhand, but long story short, you know, they never really like went like full out to stop this nuisance. And that's how we caught wind of it. Cause you know, after a few years of putting up with that, you know, you start talking to people and hearing things and going beyond just, you know, animal control and local law enforcement services.
Yeah, I did find the history of law enforcement a little shocking, that they had been out there so many times, there had been so many complaints, and they had responded to the complaints, and then they just didn't do anything about it. It just kept going. So I guess that's not that unusual in dog cases.
It was a resource allocation problem, to the best of my understanding, from digging into the public records and everything, and sort of talking with people on the ground there. So this is Vallejo, California. There's a lot of other issues there, you know, besides, you know, someone who has, you know, too many dogs on their property. Lots of issues. And if you're going to bring a case against someone, you know, like a real law enforcement action for an injunction, or, you know, there were some local ordinances being violated, I think that could have misdemeanor charges to them as well. But if you're going to prosecute a case like that, I mean, it takes an enormous amount of resources to litigate a case, you know, even a simple case, because you have to kind of budget out time and money potentially for trial to do it, and evidence gathering and legal memos and all this stuff. And so they just didn't have the resources to bring this in front of a judge and really leverage the full force of the law to stop this illegal operation.
Yeah, clearly just one of the fundamental problems in animal law is that even where laws exist, and sometimes they do, sometimes legislatures pass laws and make everybody feel better, but enforcement is hard and it's not a priority, and nobody else can bring a case. But obviously, you know, that brings up standing, and that's the first issue that would arise in anybody's mind when you think about this case. So who is the plaintiff in this case? And let's talk a little bit about standing.
Yeah. Well, actually, you said something interesting, so I want to like take a little detour there. It's not just like priority with regards to law enforcement. It's also, you know, sometimes they just have a different opinion on like a, you know, a difference in opinion about like what the law means. Or sometimes there can even be political conflicts where, you know, I see this especially when there's like a like institutional cruelty with like a research facility or a factory farm, where, you know, that's a powerful economic and political constituency that law enforcement might not want to mess with, or maybe they're networked with them in a friendly way. So there's a whole variety of reasons why laws might go unenforced.
I think that we've all given a lot of thought to what, and sometimes it's just like, we've spent our lives thinking about this. and local law enforcement has not spent their lives thinking about how laws apply to animals and animal facilities. And yeah, there's a million different reasons why cases don't get brought, even against what was in this situation, a facility that had been the subject of numerous complaints in which law enforcement had taken some interest in. So taking that next step has so often been impossible, and you were the ones who took it here. So just tell us a little bit about the plaintiff in this case, and then we'll talk a little bit about how this plaintiff came into existence.
Yeah, so we brought the lawsuit on behalf of KRU Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, which is a nonprofit in the state of California with a mission to help animals. And what's special about this organization is it's a specially incorporated, I guess the statutory language is a corporation for the prevention of cruelty to animals, but just shorthand that to like an SPCA or a humane society. But they're specially incorporated under this California statute, which is California Corporations Code Section 10400. Long story short is those special animal corporations get special statutory law enforcement powers under California law. And that's what we invoked in bringing this lawsuit.
Does the code actually create standing to bring cases?
Yeah, it does. So the provision in question comes just a few sections after the, section 10400, which defines what the corporation is and how to make one. So California Corporations Code 10404 provides, law enforcement ability and standing to these humane societies. And in particular, it says, any such corporation may proffer a complaint for the violation of any law relating to or affecting animals. So it's a pretty broad provision there, and that was at issue in this case. And I'll also note that there's another provision, Corporations Code 14501, which also sort of similarly says that these humane society corporations can force the state's animal cruelty laws as well.
Yeah, and this is not a brand new law, from my understanding is, and yet it doesn't seem to have been used very much. And it seems to be incredibly useful for animal advocates, assuming that this humane society that is interested in bringing this difficult and expensive lawsuit actually exists. My understanding is that one of the ways that you guys started thinking about it was that the courts themselves have encouraged the use of this law. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So, just to unpack a little bit there, one thing that I see happening a lot in the field of animal laws sometimes like really great laws have been on the books for like 100 years and they're just not being used. A couple examples of that in Texas, we'll broaden our geographic scope a bit here. There's this health and safety code 821.003, at least there was a few years ago when I litigated around it. It says that birds must be, like live birds have to be kept in like wholesome and sanitary conditions, something along those lines. I think just plain.
Why would I laugh?
Well, ridiculous. It's ridiculous because there's a huge egg industry in Texas that does precisely the opposite of that. I think the whole battery cage practice and operation, of which there are tens of millions of birds in Texas in battery cages, would be illegal under that provision, which has been on the books for around a century. In California, there was this everyone celebrated Proposition 8 and then Proposition 12, which required that caged egg-laying hens, pregnant pigs, and veal calves have more space to move around. However, since 1970, there's a provision, California Penal Code 597T, in the animal cruelty law that says that anyone who confines an animal shall provide an adequate exercise area. So, you know, arguably, had that law been enforced and not just laying dormant, there wouldn't have even been a need for those California propositions. And that's just a crazy issue in animal laws, having these great laws that aren't being enforced or aren't being used.
Yeah, well, the whole issue, of course, is related to, you know, the conundrum of animal law, that when these laws are violated, people aren't hurt and only people can get standing. And so the law is left not only unenforced by those in charge, but there's no way to attack it. But here you found this procedural statute that isn't just like putting a limit on what people can do to animals. It's actually providing a way that there can be a remedy to it. Of course, it's only a humane society. It's not you personally. Tell us the story of, I don't know how to put this question really. Tell us the Carew story.
Yeah. You know, I keep going on these tangents. But yeah.
That's okay. That's okay. We like tangents.
This law, 10404, has in some form has been on the books in California for over 100 years. Wasn't, as far as we can tell, really being used. There's no published appellate opinions on it being used. But you know, of course, like the statute itself is pretty plain that it gives you standing and authorizes initiating law enforcement actions like this. So the reason why we're breathing life into it in this case, some other cases, is that we. Going back to this issue of laws being unenforced in the 2000s, right? So I guess that's two decades ago now. We started the Animal Legal Defense Fund brought a lawsuit. This is Animal Legal Defense Fund v. Mendez. So this is against a calf ranch, which I think was like technically distinct from being a veal ranch, but sort of essentially the same thing, confining calves for calf meat and such. And so we brought this lawsuit against this calf ranch, and we didn't do it under this Corporations Code section 10404. We said that, you know, there's just like an implied right of action to civilly enforce the cruelty law, right, to privately enforce it. You know, if law enforcement isn't going to stop calves from being tethered into very small spaces where they can't move around, right, that's animal cruelty. Nothing's being done about it. So we brought this private lawsuit under an implied right of action for the cruelty law, and as well as under the California Unfair Competition Law, which broadly prohibits businesses from engaging in, quote, unlawful business practices, right? So animal cruelty would, of course, be an unlawful business practice. Unfortunately, in the Mendez case, the court said we didn't have that we couldn't proceed procedurally under either of those causes of action. They said that there was no, you know, they didn't recognize an implied civil private right of action to enforce the animal cruelty law. You know, they just said that doesn't exist. And then with regards to the unfair competition law claim, the California statute requires essentially an economic injury in order to have standing. And they said, you know, well, we had a consumer who said, well, I wouldn't have bought this milk if I had known that it was produced with animal cruelty. But the court in the Mendez case said, well, they weren't advertising it as being cruelty-free. They said essentially the animal cruelty was too attenuated from the decision to purchase the milk, and you know, therefore there was causation of economic injury. You know, you still got the milk with, you know, its nutritional profile that you paid for, and they weren't false advertising. But kind of sometimes there's a lose the battle, win the war. That seed was planted in the Mendez case, because the Mendez Court of Appeal in California said, well, even though you can't pursue under those two theories, you know, look, there's this whole scheme that you could use instead. And they specifically cited Corporations Code 10404 and said specially incorporated societies can proffer a complaint for the violation of laws relating to or affecting animals. So like what we're doing here isn't a grave injustice, right? It's just you did it the wrong way. And there was like some other provisions that they pointed to as well, but it was mostly 10404. And so, you know, we took them up on their offer.
It's amazing. Like some law clerk sitting in the court
thinking of a way to write this that makes it more compelling, looked at this ancient statute and said, oh, they can do that. And now you're doing it. So that's kind of an amazing story. But of course, it didn't just say that ALDF could bring a lawsuit. It had to be a humane society. And the humane societies exist in California, or SPCAs, but they have not been using this law. Why is that?
So they could be, and I suppose you could ask like an executive director of one of those humane societies, but I have a hunch why it hasn't been used by them. Typically, the sort of humane society role in the California and in most state and local ecosystems is you'll create like a private organization, and what do they care about? Well, they want to shelter animals that are homeless and abandoned, and they want to find homes for them. You know, when you think of a, you know, local humane society or a local SPCA, that's what people think about. Like I said before, bringing a lawsuit, I mean, it takes incredible resources. You have to pay for veterinary experts. You need to have experienced litigators. You know, hiring a litigator isn't inexpensive. You need to have this resource constraint. If you're filing lawsuits, you're also like opening yourself up potentially to being countersued, or, you know, maybe like abusive discovery against you. And so there's a lot of costs and a lot of risks associated with litigation. And if your primary goal is to, you know, shelter abandoned and homeless animals who in immediate need of help and find them homes, it could seem like a sideshow, really, to be doing the sort of private attorney general enforcement actions for animal cruelty or other animal law violations.
Yeah, when you think about what the reality has been and how much money there has been in the animal movement and what these humane societies were probably frequently doing heroic work. Yeah, like the law kind of shoved it onto them, like ignoring the fact that they would not have the resources to do it. So it enters ALDF and enters Karoo SPCA. So tell us how that came about.
Well, so after the Mendez decision, right, it was just you need to have a one of these specially incorporated humane societies, right? So it's not just any animal nonprofit. There's like some kind of magic like language that you should put in your articles of incorporation. I think like 20 residents of California have to sign off on it, and so there's just some like hoops you got to jump through. Animal Legal Defense Fund didn't jump through those hoops when we were incorporated back in the 1970s, so we didn't have this statutory authority, but we helped encourage the formation of Karoo SPCA, the plaintiff in this case, because it does have that statutory authority, and so having that brought about, then we now represent Karoo, and if it detects something illegal going on that's worth pursuing, or it, if we do, and we could pitch it to them. So we've formed a close relationship with this entity, and I think a pretty productive one for animals.
It sounds amazing, like a whole new world. I keep calling it Karoo, but it's Karoo. Does it stand for something?
I think it's Hindu for care or love.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Did you get pushback when you tried to set this up? Were there industry figures or figures within the government who thought, well, no, this can't be right? Even though obviously it was right and there was nothing in the law that would stop it. Did it rise to the level of attention?
No, it's pretty straightforward. At the end of the day, the whole statutory scheme for SPCAs is like, it really reflects the notion that animals don't have standing, right? Like, or at least no courts have recognized that they do. So it's not, animals don't go to court right now under their own name to enforce their rights not to be cruelly abused or, force-fed in the foie gras industry or whatever. And government, doesn't always have the resources, or, if they can save the resources, maybe you would prefer not to always have to be the one policing mistreatment of animals. And so there's really this, there's a void that needs to be filled, like this, like, you know, private civil enforcement void. And the whole, you know, the whole point of the statutory scheme, right, is, you know, corporations for the prevention of cruelty to animals. Like, they, it's like, it's a good idea, it's a good policy, and it's been codified that we want these corporations and, you know, these societies to be able to prevent cruelty to animals, and to not have to, you know, rely exclusively on the government or just have cruelty go continue unabated. So, you know, the bottom line is, no, this, you know, is there's some formalities to go through, but no, there's no pushback. I think this is really squarely in line with what the legislators envisioned when they created this scheme.
I love that. And I'm glad that you had no pushback, and I hope that continues. All right. So it has statewide jurisdiction. It's not limited to a particular locality, as a lot of SPCAs are.
Yeah, I think when SPCAs limit themselves to a locality, it's sort of due to like corporate charter constraints or,
okay,
right, like our mission is to, you know, serve the, you know, the Los Angeles area or serve the Sacramento area. Maybe there's like insurance stuff there. And then, and oftentimes, but not always, oftentimes these local humane societies will enter into contracts with, you know, with a county or city government to provide, right, to provide services.
Yeah.
So there's all these, you know, a lot of non-legal, non-statutory sort of self-finding that tends to make humane societies local, but there's nothing in this corporation code 10-400 scheme that requires a humane society to limit itself to a particular local jurisdiction.
And while I don't want anybody to quote me on this, I think that's different in New York State. And it's good to keep in mind that all of these laws are state laws. And so things are going to vary from state to state on how this works. And it sounds like California has an excellent scheme here. So also, a humane society such as KRU can actually bring a case according to the statute. Is there any limit on the type of relief that can be sought, or is it exactly the same as if a prosecutor brought a case?
They don't specifically explain what kind of relief can be obtained, which is an issue that can be litigated and that we have had to litigate. You know, in California, as well as elsewhere, courts have sort of like a background inherent equitable relief authority. Right. So sort of, you know, all things being equal, unless otherwise stated, courts can enjoin violations of laws as part of their authority. So that's sort of like, you know, I think just automatically a part of the statute. In addition to that, if you are bringing like a criminal, something based on like a violation of the criminal law, for example, you know, it certainly appears that you would be able to seek whatever relief the underlying statute was authorizing, mm-hmm, as well. So, you know, that's something that's
very broad.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of things about the statute are so broad. It's really a lot to explore here. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Oh no, and I think that's just consistent with the whole, you know, the scheme preventing cruelty to animals, right? That you wouldn't want to limit the relief available, and so the statute doesn't limit the relief.
So, In the case we're actually going to be talking about at some point, I'm going to get to it in a minute. The laws that you claimed were violated were the municipal code and a state law regarding breeding. Basically, let's start out by talking about these statutes, and then we'll get into how they applied to the story you were telling us about what was going on at this breeding facility. So there was not a criminal action here. This wasn't under the cruelty code. So let's start with the Vallejo Municipal Code. What provisions were at play in this case that you identified as being potentially violated by this facility?
In the municipal code, right, and again, so always thinking about the statute and the statutory interpretation, it says that these corporations can proffer a complaint for, quote, any law relating to or affecting animal. So it's not limited to state law. It's not limited to local law. You know, I think potentially even federal law would be fair game here. And so the municipal code for Vallejo does have laws that relate to and affect animals. And there were several of them. One was, I think, probably the most obviously violated. You can only have four dogs. So there's a four dog limit in the within the ordinance. Then there's a prohibition on dogs running at large. So that was another important one as well. We also included a claim for there was a privacy fence that actually was too high, but that was relating to animals because it was concealing the violations related to the operation.
So let me just interrupt you a second to clarify. Now, in this instance, it was relating to animals, but the municipal code provision was just a general provision that referred to any fence?
Yeah, that's correct.
And you related it. Okay.
Yeah, so it was in fact related to animals.
These types of regulations are fairly common in municipal codes, I imagine. Do you think that municipal codes, assuming there is a way to get standing, are a fruitful avenue for animal lawyers? Should everyone be sitting down and going through all of these codes and seeing what might be being violated?
Yes. Anytime someone sues, you know, an animal exploiting operation, 100% they should look through the municipal codes. It's kind of, you know, it's interesting when you litigate or, you know, when you're engaged in animal law, there's this sort of like just randomness to it. If, you know, maybe there's some kind of case law from 30 years ago relating, you know, for some statute you want to bring a case under, and maybe it went one way or the other just for kind of random reasons or, right? But relatedly, I guess the point of that is sometimes you have a fact pattern and some of that random stuff is like, did someone ever pass a regulation, or is there just some kind of random statute that just kind of pertains to it for some reason? And I see that a lot in these local ordinances and these local codes, that there's usually some section dealing with animals. Sometimes you'll be surprised by what you find there. It's not really consistent between local jurisdiction to local jurisdiction, that, like, you know, sometimes they'll add some provisions in there that you don't see everywhere else. And so it's always worth looking at the local law to see if there's something relevant, some relevant violation.
Yeah, I think that I think it's an excellent point, and I have found that to be the case as well, that sometimes you just find a statute. And also sometimes I have found you find a statute, it seems to say something good, and 50 years ago, there was some bad decision under it, and people tend to write it off. But, you know, and it's a usually very lower court decision. It doesn't really mean that statute can't ever be used. So, yeah, research is a hugely important part of animal law. That's for sure. Just diligent, diligent research. But it wasn't only municipal law that was involved here. There was also a state law, the Pet Breeder Warranty Act. Can you tell us who that law applies to and what it requires?
Yeah. And again, this is another good reason to, you know, to do your due diligence. I call this going down the rabbit hole when I'm researching a case. And that's just like, I'm just going to pull up the statute, you know, the state statute or and the local code, and just literally go through the table of contents and look for, you know, sniff out anything that might be relevant. Sometimes there's like a tendency to do kind of in the box thinking. Like, everyone knows every state has an animal cruelty law, and you know, having a bunch of dogs in unsanitary conditions, it might be easy enough just to kind of round that up to just call that animal cruelty, dust off your hands and make a claim on that and be done with it. But California has this Pet Breeder Warranty Act, which I hadn't heard of before researching this case. Essentially, it's like related to the puppy lemon law in the state, right? So there's these like sort of dog breeding and dog sale statute in the health and safety code in California. And as part of that, breeders have certain obligations. For example, you have to keep your dogs in quote sanitary conditions, and so that is a welfare, you know, animal protection requirement within what's mostly sort of a consumer protection statute. It was that sanitary condition was really the thrust of our Pet Breeder Warranty Act violations, because of the reports, you know, too many dogs, accumulation of dog waste, the smell of urine, flies, which was, you know, you know, radiating beyond the property itself and affecting the neighbors. And so that, as well as the dogs, of course, living in those conditions. So that was the Pet Breeder Warranty Act violation.
You never went to hearing, didn't you? You did this on motions for summary judgment, is that right?
Yeah, we never went to trial. We won on summary judgment, that's correct, yeah.
I mean, you're talking about all these things happened, but how did you gather this evidence? I mean, there were complaints made, so how did you find out about that? But there were also, you know, you also needed evidence to show that this was really happening. How did you prove your case? This is the part that you were talking about, why when humane societies just give up and say, we can't do that, that's not within our ability.
When you're doing litigation, is actually, my view is you'll never get them to give you documents or testimony that'll win your case once you sue them. So really, it's good to be able to prove your case, like to have it essentially proven before you even file the lawsuit is the best thing to do. And fortunately, we were essentially able to do that because the animal control reports, you know, the essentially testimony from animal control officers that had been visiting this property over the years. I mean, that was great evidence. You know, more than 50 dogs could smell, you know, feces and urine as I, you know, walked up to the door to talk to her. And those are all public records. It qualifies for a hearsay exemption because it is a government public, you know, contemporaneous government public record that's sort of generated and kept in the ordinary course of business. So you don't even have to depose the officers. Like that is great evidence right there. We also hired a private investigator to go there. We have the neighbor testimony, right? Keep in mind that these neighbors had been complaining about the property, but they're witnesses to all this stuff as well. So you have the neighbor testimony, and we did engage with an expert, a veterinary forensic expert on cat and dog issues and other animal issues, and you know, and she looked at all the evidence and sort of explained what the welfare implications were for the animals living under these conditions, and so essentially that was our case.
It is kind of unbelievable when you think about it that most of your case was made out by actual reports by law enforcement who had done nothing these years. Like, there's something really sad about that. So what were the defenses? What did she bring to bear?
She claimed that the conditions were, you know, exaggerated, right? So that was probably the main defense. That
did she bring any evidence?
Her own testimony, and there were... Uh-huh. She did submit declarations from people who had knowledge of the property who sided with her. And so, you know, so there was some defense there. You know, and she also, you know, she was claiming like, look, these trying to generate some sympathy because she's breeding a rare species of dog, you know, and I don't think she's a bad person either, by the way. Like, you know, she didn't see herself that way. Just like incapable of managing, of having dogs and having a breeding operation, you know, in my view. But she, you know, certainly she didn't see herself that way. They did make her and her lawyer, that's what I mean by they, made an issue of, you know, whether, I think they alleged that like Kairu was an illegitimate SPCA withstanding because there was no cruelty or animal mistreatment happening. So there was sort of a standing argument made. That was essentially it. And, you know, I will note that there was another issue in the case, which was that the defendant was not like complying with deadlines and procedures in this case. And there were multiple instances of that happening. And then it culminated when we, you know, asked her to admit things, right? In discovery, you can propound what are called requests for admissions. And so we had asked her to admit, you know, that she had more than this, you know, so many dogs, that, you know, she's, you know, keeping them in unsanitary conditions. And, you know, we had a list of things we wanted her to admit or deny. And she ended up blowing off the deadline for that pretty egregiously. So we got those admitted, you know, deemed admitted as part of the mm-hmm. proceeding. So that was key to winning some of our claims on summary judgments. although like I said, like we had all the evidence there. Anyways,
one thing that struck me from what you said about evidence is that she had neighbors and other people on her side. You had neighbors and other people on your side, and that could be the end of the case, or it could have at least forced it to go to trial. But it, again, it was these law enforcement reports over the years, and also you pointed out the admissions. But those law enforcement reports must have been that if I were the judge, that would have been very, very compelling evidence to me.
Yeah, and you know, I'm confident that we would have won at trial.
Yeah, I see.
We actually had originally, you know, we'd moved for summary judgment even before those requests had been deemed admitted. So, you know, I think the evidence is really compelling in this case. But, you know, because of the admissions that perhaps pushed us over the finish line on I think just on one of the claims. So.
And did you win on all the claims?
Yep. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So so even without those requests for admissions being deemed admitted, we'd won on all of the municipal code violations. So that would have been a partial summary judgment. And then we also won on the Pet Breeder Warranty Act violations as well. So that's, at that point, we've established that she was violating the law. And then really the only two issues then were, you know, what to do about it and then whether she would appeal.
And what did the court do about it?
Yeah, so this is really, I think this is a really important and interesting part of the case as well, which is, so after we, you know, as we say in the business, win on the merits, that's, you know, the judge said that, yeah, she is violating the law and you have the right to do something about it. So then the question is, well, like, what's the remedy? What's the outcome here? And we had asked, we moved for a permanent injunction that would prohibit the defendant from having, you know, control, custody, possession, et cetera, of dogs, because she had proven to be unable or unwilling or both to comply with the law, right? Years of animal control officers telling her, you know, you got to clean up the act, and she wasn't able to do that. The defendant wasn't able to comply with like simple court orders and instructions throughout the litigation. And we said, look, you know, you can't just tell her, you know, keep four dogs and keep the premises clean. Like that's, cause that's not going to be sufficient. And the whole point of injunctive relief is to issue an injunction or a court order that will stop the violation of law from happening. And the only way to do that in this case is, you know, frankly, like she can't be trusted to have dogs. So the court agreed with us, entered an injunction prohibiting the defendant from having, you know, essentially, you know, custody or control of dogs until she can convince the court otherwise, right? So I suppose in the future, she could move the court to modify the injunction for good cause or something along those lines. Additionally, as part of that order, you know, there's this question, well, what do you do with the dogs that are there? So the court authorized, you know, included some provisions authorizing us to go to the property to rescue the animals and so that we could, you know, place them with a rescue organization and have them adopted out. And that would be things like, the defendant has to give us an inventory of all the dogs before we show up, you know, has to allow us onto the premises to get the dogs, document their relationship and their conditions so that we can provide proper veterinary care after the rescue and so forth. So the injunction also included provisions along those lines.
Well, this is also another part of the very expensive proposition that animal law can be, is that frequently the plaintiffs end up with the animals. What kind of arrangements had you make beforehand? Because I know that one of the claims in her papers was that they'll just kill all these dogs. That's, you know, which is frequently the claim that defendants make in cases involving cruelty to animals. Like, at least we're keeping them alive. So what kind of arrangements were you able to make for the dogs?
To jump ahead a little bit, she did end up filing an appeal. And in California, every state and jurisdiction can be different about like what happens to an injunction or a damage award after an appeal. In California, the injunction is automatically stayed pending the appeal, except for some various exceptions. And so we haven't actually been able to execute this yet. Mm. We are winding our way through the appeal, but and be more responsive to your question about what kind of arrangements are made. Again, sort of the flip side of humane societies being focused on sheltering and rehoming animals rather than litigation. Well, a flip side of that is when you're a litigator, like you're not directly in the business of being experts on taking animals and providing them veterinary care. So we do partner, Animal Legal Defense Fund will partner with other organizations whose core function is rescuing animals. And we work closely and coordinate with them to find homes. And luckily, for cats and dogs, right? Like unfortunately we're in a system where millions of cats and dogs every year are abandoned, kind of go through the shelter or rescue system and are rehomed. So there's a huge infrastructure for that. It actually becomes, I think, more of an issue in our roadside zoo or similar cases involving wild animals, particularly like the bigger, kind of megafauna wild animals. Like you could imagine like a, like apes or elephants or animals like that can be more hard to find sanctuary space for them.
Yeah, I recently had Brittany Pete on from PETA talking about the Tiger King issues and what do you do with all of those tigers? This is a very expensive proposition. There are good sanctuaries out there, but geez, like you can't expect them to clean up all of this nightmare. And it also brings up kind of the case we started talking about this, which was Mendez, which was a farm animal case. Do you expect to be, I mean, certainly rehoming farm animals, that many farm animals would be very, very difficult. But aside from that, do you fear that if you start using this statute against factory farms, you might end up just proving too much and that it's all illegal, which it clearly is, as we all know, that everything they do is illegal. And what would happen? Would it lead to the end of factory farming as we know it or the end of this law?
Well, that's an interesting tension that you hit on there. With regards to, factory farm cases, I think it's really important to think about the context here. But Mendez involves, animal agriculture, factory farm. It's the calf meat, which is, related to the dairy industry, because that's where the calves, the sort of the surplus calves are coming from, so the dairy industry. There was another case also under California's unfair competition law alleging something similar. That was a farm sanctuary had brought a case around the same time where they were the plaintiff. And then Animal Legal Defense Fund a couple years later, before we filed this sort of special corporation code 10404 action, had filed a taxpayer action against the state of California because the University of California and the State Fair, which are both state-funded state agencies, were exhibiting pigs and farrowing crates in violation of that law I mentioned earlier.
I remember that case, yeah.
That was Animal Legal Defense Fund versus California Exposition and State Fair.
Brilliant theory. It didn't work, but it was a brilliant theory.
Well, yeah, because the taxpayer statute says that any taxpayer can sue to enjoin any illegal expenditure. Any illegal expenditure. So we're like, well, an expenditure where you're illegally confining animals without an adequate exercise area in violation of the cruelty law, that's an illegal expenditure. Buying the farrowing crates, paying for the property and the equipment and the staff time that oversees it. Those are all illegal expenditures directly tied to animal cruelty. And we lost that case on procedural grounds as well. And we were redirected back to this Section 10404 scheme. And the reason that I bring all that up is because, what do these have in common? Well, these are all cases involving animal agriculture and farmed animals. And I think at the end of the day, what I really suspect is going on is that there's a discomfort with the idea that there could be common, perhaps widespread, perhaps ubiquitous animal cruelty happening within a huge industry, which is the animal agriculture industry, and rather than confront that head on, rather than confront the merits of it, I think there's like a human psychological component here of just like, well, let's just rule against them on procedural grounds and not rule that. Because could you imagine in that Cal Expo case, how ridiculous, if they got to the merits, how ridiculous it would be to say confining a pig for 2 weeks in a farrowing crate where she can't move around, you know, more than an inch in any direction, that that is, quote, an adequate exercise area in compliance with the Cal.
They have no way out.
There's no way out. And that would be the University of California School, Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, one of the top, you know, veterinary, one of the top, I think top two or the top animal agriculture veterinary programs in the country, is a finding that they are engaged in animal cruelty by using these farrowing crates where, you know, pigs are trapped and can't move for 2 weeks. I mean, that is like, you know, that's pretty explosive, you know, in terms of legal findings. And a better way out of that situation is to just find procedural grounds. And I don't know that anyone was like intentionally thinking about it that way. Like, I suppose that maybe the University of California was.
I think they were. I think you're being too kind here. I think that's exactly what they were thinking.
Yeah, that's kind of a fault of mine. Maybe I'm being too generous there. The procedural tension, I call it the doctrine of like a uncomfortable question abstention. It's like it's a form of abstention that's kind of rooted in human psychology and legal realism.
And just the eagerness. I mean, I worked in a court for many years, and the eagerness to avoid the question is rampant. So you may have opened a Pandora's box here. I hope it's one from which many animals will be able to flee.
You know, if I could actually interject, we didn't open the pan. There's no Pandora's box, and we're not opening it. This is something the California legislature 100 years ago said they want us to do. They want nonprofits to prevent cruelty to animals. And so we're just executing the will of this, you know, what's been the policy of the state of California for a century.
And I hope it stays the policy of California, because actually changing this at this point would expose, even if they had to mount a legislative campaign to change these laws, if that was the only way to stop you, that would be hugely controversial. They would have to fight for some really horrifying things. So I think I can't wait to see what happens next. I know you have another puppy case in the hopper, and we don't have time to talk about it, but it has to do with California's retail pet sale ban and ways people are trying to find their way around that. So I hope when that case develops a little further, you'll come on to talk about that as well. And any other cases that you are pursuing under these theories, I find it so fascinating.
Yeah, you know, I'm always happy to talk about it. And I think that the ability of, you know, animal protection groups to, you know, directly enforce animal protection laws is an issue that I think has been neglected far too long in the animal law and the animal protection movement. Because what good are these laws? The retail pet sale ban, for example, that if a pet stores can only, California says pet stores can't sell cats and dogs and rabbits unless they came from a rescue organization. So what happened? Well, puppy mills just they fraudulently created sham rescue corporations as nonprofits, and they literally just laundered puppies through them to the pet stores. And that was the basis of the lawsuit. But in that case, law enforcement, I actually spoke with law enforcement, and their view was that actually was a legitimate loophole, that they didn't think they would win that in court. And so they didn't want to devote the resources to that. And we disagreed with it. And so we brought this case. But what good is a ban on the sale of puppy mill dogs in pet stores if you can't enforce it? And I've seen that with other laws, California's ban on the sale of foie gras. You know, I see it in other states throughout the country as well, that when these laws are passed, that there's not always the ability to vigorously enforce them and make sure that they're...
Absolutely.
So
it makes the legislature feel very good to say something is against the law. But if you're not going to create the ability to enforce it, it's not really accomplishing much. So it is unfortunate that organizations that have been put into place to protect animals have to spend their resources doing the government's job. But I'm so glad that they are. And thank you for sharing this with us today. I'm looking forward to what else happens on this front.
Great. Well, thanks for focusing attention on it. And like I said, happy to chat about this anytime. So thanks so much for having me on.
So thanks so much for joining us on the Animal Law Podcast. We'll be back next month with a new show.
And thank you so much to Christopher Berry for taking the time to tell us about all of these exciting developments. Thank you also to Jen Riley and Jarob Gleckel for their help in producing the podcast. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider subscribing wherever you listen to podcasts. Consider leaving us a good review there or on Apple Podcasts. And if you're able, please consider making a tax-deductible donation at ourhenhouse.org. Thank you so much for tuning in, and please continue to keep safe.